I don't know if you have read the story of the life of Vivekananda. Have you? No. I think you should give one copy. One day we should keep only for that purpose. That would be a good idea, because Sri Aurobindo quotes Vivekananda from time to time in the synthesis of yoga. Now let me read to you this powers of the mind. This is in connection with the Raja Yoga of which I was speaking yesterday. Mental powers. How do you develop the mental powers? What kind of powers are there? Now this is a lecture given by Swami Vivekananda at California on January 8, 1900. All over the world, there has been the belief in the supernatural throughout the ages. All of us have heard of extraordinary happenings, and many of us have had some personal experience of them. I would rather introduce the subject by telling you certain facts which have come within my own experience. I once heard of a man who, if anyone went to him with questions in his mind, would answer them immediately. And I was also informed that he foretold events. I was curious and went to see him with a few friends. We each had something in our minds to ask, and to avoid mistakes, we wrote down our questions and put them in our pockets. As soon as the man saw one of us, he repeated our questions and gave the answers to them. Then he wrote something on paper, which he folded up, asked me to sign on the back, and said, "Don't look at it. Put it in your pocket and keep it there till I ask for it again." And so on to each one of us. He next told us about some events that would happen to us in the future. Then he said, "Now, think of a word or a sentence from any language you like." I thought of a long sentence from Sanskrit, a language of which he was entirely ignorant. "Now, take out the paper from your pocket," he said. The Sanskrit sentence was written there. He had written it an hour before with the remark, "In confirmation of what I have written, this man will think of this sentence." It was correct. Another of us who had been given a similar paper, which he had signed and placed in his pocket, was also asked to think of a sentence. He thought of a sentence in Arabic, which it was still less possible for him, for the man to know. It was some passage from the Quran. And my friend found this written down on the paper. Another was a physician. He thought of a sentence from a German medical book. It was written on his paper. Several days later, I went to this man again, thinking possibly I had been deluded somehow before. I took other friends, and on this occasion also, he came out wonderfully triumphant. Another time, I was in the city of Hyderabad in India, and I was told of a Brahmin there who could produce numbers of things from where nobody knew. This man was in business there. He was a respectable gentleman. And I asked him to show me his tricks. It so happened that this man had a fever, and in India there is a general belief that if a holy man puts his hand on a sick man, he would be well. This Brahmin came to me and said, "Sir, put your hand on my head so that my fever may be cured." I said, "Very good, but you show me your tricks." He promised. I put my hand on his head as desired, and later he came to fulfill his promise. He had only a strip of cloth about his loins. We took off everything else from him. I had a blanket which I gave him to wrap around himself because it was cold, and made him sit a corner. 25 pairs of eyes were looking at him, and he said, "Now look, write down anything you want." We all wrote down names of fruits that never grew in that country, bunches of grapes, oranges, and so on. And we gave him those bits of paper. And there came from under his blanket bushes of grapes, oranges, and so forth. So much that if all that fruit was weighed, it would have been twice as heavy as the man. He asked us to eat the fruit. Some of us objected, thinking it was hypnotism. But the man began eating himself. So we all ate. It was all right. He ended by producing a mass of roses. Each flower was perfect, with dew drops on the petals, not one crushed, not one injured, and masses of them. When I asked the man for an explanation, he said, "It is all sleight of hand." Whatever it was, it seemed to be impossible that it could be sleight of hand merely. From whence could he have got such large quantities of things? Well, I saw many things like that. Going about India, you find hundreds of similar things in different places. These are in every country. Even in this country, you will find some such wonderful things. Of course, there is a great deal of fraud, no doubt. But then, whenever you see fraud, you have also to say that fraud is an imitation. There must be some truth somewhere that is being imitated. You cannot imitate nothing. Imitation must be of something substantially true. In very remote times in India, thousands of years ago, these facts used to happen even more than they do today. It seems to me that when a country becomes very thickly populated, psychical power deteriorates. Given a vast country thinly inhabited, there will perhaps be more of psychical powers there. These facts, the Hindus, being analytically minded, took up and investigated, and they came to certain remarkable conclusions. That is, they made a science of it. They found that all these, though extraordinary, are natural. There is nothing supernatural. They are under laws just the same as any other physical phenomenon. It is not a freak of nature that a man is born with such powers. They can be systematically studied, practiced, and acquired. This science they call the science of Raja Yoga. There are thousands of people who cultivate the study of this science, and for the whole nation it has become a part of daily worship. The conclusion they have reached is that all these extraordinary powers are in the mind of man. This mind is a part of the universal mind. Each mind is connected with every other mind. And each mind, wherever it is located, is in actual communication with the whole world. Have you ever noticed the phenomenon that is called thought transference? A man here is thinking something, and that thought is manifested in somebody else, in some other place, with preparation, not by chance. A man wants to send a thought to another mind at a distance. And this other mind knows that the thought is coming, and he receives it exactly as it is sent out. Distance makes no difference. The thought goes and reaches the other man, and he understands it. If your mind were an isolated something here, and my mind were an isolated something there, and there were no connection between the two, how would it be possible for my thought to reach you? In the ordinary cases, it is not my thought that is reaching you direct, but my thought has got to be dissolved into ethereal vibrations, and those ethereal vibrations go into your brain, and they have to be resolved again into your own thoughts. Here is a dissolution of thought, and there is a resolution of thought. It is a roundabout process, but in telepathy, there is no such thing. It is direct. This shows that there is a continuity of mind, as the yogis call it. The mind is universal. Your mind, my mind, all these little minds are fragments of that universal mind. Little waves in the ocean. And on account of this continuity, we can convey our thoughts directly to one another. You see what is happening all around us. The world is one of influence. Part of our energy is used up in the preservation of our own bodies. Beyond that, every particle of our energy is day and night being used in influencing others. Our bodies, our virtues, our intellect, our spiritualities, all these are continuously influencing others. And so conversely, we are being influenced by them. This is going on all around us. Now, to take a concrete example, a man comes, you know he is very learned, his language is beautiful, and he speaks to you by the hour. But he does not make any impression. Another man comes and he speaks a few words, not well arranged, ungrammatical perhaps. All the same, he makes an immense impression. Many of you have seen that. So it is evident that words alone cannot always produce an impression. Words, even thoughts, contribute only one-third of the influence in making an impression. The man differs. What you call the personal magnetism of the man, that is what goes out and impresses you. You may remember perhaps, or if you don't know his life, Swami Vivekananda went to America in 1893. He attended Parliament of Religions. It was the first Parliament of Religions. When he went from India to America, he was only told that there is a Parliament of Religions, and his friend said, why don't you go and address there? He had no warm clothes. The king of Khetri gave him a shawl as a gift. That was the only woolen thing that he had with him. He had no pass to present himself at the Parliament of Religions. He was not sent by any institution in India. He went on his own. He did not even inquire as to how he'll be able to address there. He was so innocent, like you. And then he found over there somebody. It's a good story actually. If you read the whole story, it's very interesting. He had to sleep in the first night in a small box on a pavement because he had no house, no place to go to in that cold in America. Later on, some professor came to know him, and then he took him to the Parliament of Religions office for registration. And then the man who was registering said, what is your credential? On whose behalf you want to address in the Parliament of Religions. So that professor in the meantime was so impressed by Vivekananda, he said, to ask credentials from this man is to ask the sun to give credentials for his light. It's a tremendous tribute that was paid to this man, to Vivekananda, unknown man, young man. To ask credentials from this man is like asking the sun to give credentials for its light. The sunlight is self-evident. There is no need of a credential. Sun and sun's light, both are one and the same. Similarly, this man and his credentials are the same thing. So that is how he was allowed to enter into Parliament of Religions. And the lectures began one by one. And somebody asked him, now you speak. And he was so shy, he could not even get up and spoke. Only 5 minutes were left for the time of that day to close the session. And then he was summoned and said, now you speak. He stood up and he spoke only 3 words. Sisters and brothers of America. Only 3 words he spoke. And the entire audience was so surcharged. They all stood up and gave standing ovation and clapped only on hearing these 3 words, sisters and brothers of America. And then he spoke only for 5 minutes. One day you should read the short speech. I think you can give one short speech. We have given that, yes. So you kindly, it's a very short speech that he gave for 5 minutes. But next day, in all the papers in America, he was on the headlines. None other, only this man, this young man, he was on the headlines. So it proves what he says here, that a man comes, he speaks only a few words, and the whole mass becomes influenced. This is the power. It is because when you speak, it's not the mouth that speaks, it is not the words that speak. It is the man who speaks, the spirit that is there. The tapasya that he had done, so much of tapasya he had done, he had walked around the whole of the country absolutely without any possessions, aparigraha, without any possessions at all. And all the time moving up and down, with only one thing, let my country awake, let my country be great. All the time offering his country to the feet of the Lord, nothing else in his life. It is this tapasya. And the words that came out, they were not incidental words. The formula, sisters and brothers of America. Whole of India is the sense of universality. And that universality was born in his tongue, as it were. When he said, sisters and brothers of America, there was no difference between Indians and Americans. They were all sisters and brothers. So that universality manifested in 3 words. It is that which produced such a tremendous effect. In fact, one of the greatest events of the last century was visit of Vivekananda to America. One of the greatest events. He went as a young man, without any possessions, without even knowing how to present himself in the Parliament of Religions, and he was turned into the greatest orator, the best representative of the Parliament of Religion. So, this is the proof of what he says here. In our families, there are the heads. Some of them are successful, others are not. In our families, there are the heads. Some of them are successful, others are not. Why? We complain of others in our failures. The moment I am unsuccessful, I say, so and so is the cause of the failure. In failure, one does not like to confess one's own faults and weaknesses. Each person tries to hold himself faultless and lay the blame upon somebody or something else, or even on bad luck. When heads of families fail, they should ask themselves why it is that some persons manage a family so well and others do not. Then you will find that the difference is owing to the man, his presence, his personality. Coming to great leaders of mankind, we always find that it was the personality of the man that counted. Now take all the great authors of the past, the great thinkers. Really speaking, how many thoughts have they thought? Take all the writings that have been left to us by the past leaders of mankind. Take each one of their books and appraise them. The real thoughts, new and genuine, that have been thought in this world up to this time, amount to only a handful. Only to a handful. Read in their books the thoughts they have left to us. The authors do not appear to be giants to us, and yet we know that they were great giants in their days. What made them so? Not simply the thoughts they thought, neither the books they wrote, nor the speeches they made. It was something else that is now gone. That is their personality. As I already remarked, the personality of the man is 2/3, and his intellect, his words are but 1/3. It is the real man, the personality of the man, that runs through us. Our actions are but effects. Actions must come when the man is there. The effect is bound to follow the cause. The ideal of all education, all training, should be this man-making. But instead of that, we are always trying to polish up the outside. What use in polishing up the outside when there is no inside? The end and aim of all training is to make the man grow. The man who influences, who throws his magic, as it were, upon his fellow beings, is a dynamo of power. And when that man is ready, he can do anything and everything he likes. That personality put upon anything will make it work. Now we see that though this is a fact, no physical laws that we know of will explain this. How can we explain it by chemical and physical knowledge? How much of oxygen, hydrogen, carbon, how many molecules in different positions, and how many cells, etc., etc., can explain this mysterious personality? And we still see it is a fact. And not only that, it is the real man. And it is that man that lives and moves and works. It is that man that influences, moves his fellow beings, and passes out, and his intellect and books and works are but traces left behind. Think of this. Compare the great teachers of religion with the great philosophers. The philosophers scarcely influenced anybody's inner man, and yet they wrote most marvelous books. The religious teachers, on the other hand, moved countries in their lifetime. The difference was made by personality. In the philosopher, it is a faint personality that influences. In the great prophets, it is tremendous. In the former, we touch the intellect. In the latter, we touch life. In the one case, it is simply a chemical process. Putting certain chemical ingredients together, it may gradually combine and under proper circumstances bring out a flash of light or may fail. In the other, it is like a torch that goes round quickly, lighting others. the science of yoga claims that it has discovered the laws which develop this personality. And by proper attention to these laws and methods, each one can grow and strengthen his personality. This is one of the great practical things, and this is the secret of all education. This has a universal application. In the life of the householder, in the life of the poor, the rich, the man of business, the spiritual man, in everyone's life, it is a great thing, the strengthening of this personality. There are laws, very fine, which are behind the physical laws, as we know. That is to say, there are no such realities as a physical world, a mental world, a spiritual world. Whatever is one. Let us say, it is a sort of tapering existence. The thickest part is here, it tapers and becomes finer and finer. The finest is what we call spirit. The grossest, the body. And just as it is here in the microcosm, it is exactly the same in the macrocosm. These two words you should learn quite well, microcosm and macrocosm. Microcosm is something that is smallest. Macrocosm is that which is the largest. What is in the microcosm is also in the macrocosm. And what is in the macrocosm is also in the microcosm. The universe of ours is exactly like that. It is a gross external thickness. And it tapers into something finer and finer until it becomes God. We also know that the greatest power is lodged in the fine, not in the coarse. We see a man take up a huge weight. We see his muscles swell. And all over his body we see signs of exertion. And we think the muscles are powerful things. But it's the thin thread-like things, the nerves, which bring power to the muscles. The moment one of these threads is cut off from reaching the muscles, they are not able to work at all. These tiny nerves bring the power from something still finer. And that again, in its turn, brings it from something finer still. Thought and so on. So it is the fine that is really the seat of power. Of course, we can see the movements in the gross. But when fine movements take place, we cannot see them. When a gross thing moves, we catch it. And thus we naturally identify movement with things which are gross. But all the power is really in the fine. Fine means subtle. We do not see any movement in the fine. Perhaps because the movement is so intense that we cannot perceive it. But if by any science, any investigation, we are helped to get hold of these finer forces, which are the cause of the expression itself will be under control. There is a little doubt. There is a little bubble coming from the bottom of a lake. We do not see it coming all the time. We see it only when it bursts on the surface. So we can perceive thoughts only after they develop a great deal, only after they become actions. We constantly complain that we have no control over our actions, over our thoughts. But how can we have it? If we can get control over the fine movements, if we can get hold of thought at the root, before it has become thought, before it has become action, then it would be possible for us to control the whole. Now, if there is a method by which we can analyze, investigate, understand, and finally grapple with those finer powers, the finer causes, then alone is it possible to have control over ourselves. And the man who has control over his own mind assuredly will have control over every other mind. That is why purity and morality have been always the object of religion. A pure moral man has control of himself. And all minds are the same, different parts of one mind. He who knows one lump of clay has known all the clay in the universe. He who knows and controls his own mind knows the secret of every mind and has the power over every mind. Now, a good deal of our physical evil we can get rid of if we have control over the fine parts. A good many worries we can throw off if we have control over the fine movements. A good many failures can be averted if you have control over these fine powers. So far is utility. Yet beyond, there is something higher. Now I shall tell you a theory, which I will not argue now, but simply place before you the conclusion. Each man in his childhood runs through the stages through which his race has come up. Only the race took thousands of years to do it, while the child takes a few years. The child is first the old savage man, and he crushes a butterfly under his feet. The child is at first like the primitive ancestors of his race. As he grows, he passes through different stages until he reaches the development of his race. Only does it swiftly and quickly. Now take the whole of humanity as a race, or take the whole of the animal creation, man and the lower animals, as one whole. There is an end towards which the whole is moving. Let us call it perfection. Some men and women are born who anticipate the whole progress of mankind. Instead of waiting and being reborn over and over again for ages until the whole human race has attained to that perfection, they, as it were, rush through them in a few short years of their life. And we know that we can hasten these processes if we be true to ourselves. If a number of men without any culture be left to live upon an island, and are given barely enough food, clothing and shelter, they will gradually go on and on, evolving higher and higher stages of civilization. We know also that this growth can be hastened by additional means. We help the growth of trees, do we not? Left to nature, they would have grown, only they would have taken a longer time. We help them to grow in a shorter time than they would otherwise have taken. We are doing all the time the same thing, hastening the growth of things by artificial means. Why cannot we hasten the growth of man? We can do that as a race. Why are teachers sent to other countries? Because by these means we can hasten the growth of races. Now, can we not hasten the growth of individuals? We can. Can we put a limit to the hastening? We cannot say how much a man can grow in one life. You have no reason to say that this much a man can do and no more. Circumstances can hasten him wonderfully. Can there be any limit then, till you come to perfection? So what comes of it? That a perfect man, that is to say, type that is to come of this race, perhaps millions of years hence, that man can become today. And this is what the yogis say, that all great incarnations and prophets are such men, that they reach perfection in this one life. We have had such men at all periods of the world's history, and at all times. Quite recently, there was such a man who lived the life of the whole human race and reached the end even in this life. He refers to his own teacher, Sri Ramakrishna. Even this hastening of the growth must be under laws. Suppose we can investigate these laws and understand their secrets and apply them to our own needs, it follows that we grow. We hasten our growth, we hasten our development, and we become perfect even in this life. This is the higher part of our life, and the science of the study of mind and its powers has this perfection as its real end. Helping others with money and other material things and teaching them how to go on smoothly in their daily life are mere details. The utility of this science is to bring out the perfect man and not let him wait and wait for ages, just as a plaything in the hands of the physical world, like a log of driftwood, carried from wave to wave and tossing about in the ocean. This science wants you to be strong, to take the work in your own hand, instead of leaving it in the hands of nature, and get beyond this little life. That is the great idea. Man is growing in knowledge, in power, in happiness. Continuously we are growing as a race. We see that is true, perfectly true. Is it true of individuals? To a certain extent, yes. But yet again comes the question, where do you fix the limit? I can see only at a distance of so many feet. But I have seen a man close his eyes and see what is happening in another room. If you say you do not believe it, perhaps in 3 weeks that man can come you do the same. It can be taught to anybody. Some persons in 5 minutes even can be made to read what is happening in another man's mind. These facts can be demonstrated. Now, if these things are true, where can we put a limit? If a man can read what is happening in another's mind in the corner of this room, why not in the next room? Why not anywhere? We cannot say why not. We dare not say that it is not possible. We can only say we do not know how it happens. Material scientists have no right to say that things like this are not possible. They can only say we do not know. Science has to collect facts, generalize upon them, deduce principles, and state the truth. That is all. But if you begin by denying the facts, how can a science be? There is no end to the power a man can obtain. This is the peculiarity of the Indian mind, that when anything interests it, it gets absorbed in it and other things are neglected. You know how many sciences had their origin in India. Mathematics began here. You are even today counting 1, 2, 3, etc. to 0, after Sanskrit figures. And you all know that algebra also originated in India, and that gravitation was known to the Indians thousands of years before Newton was born. You see the peculiarity. At a certain period of Indian history, this one subject of man and his mind absorbed all their interests. And it was so enticing because it seemed the easiest way to achieve their ends. Now, the Indian mind became so thoroughly persuaded that the mind could do anything and everything according to law, that its powers became the great object of studies. Charms, magic and other powers, and all that were nothing extraordinary, but a regularly taught science, just as the physical sciences they had taught before that. Such a conviction in these things came upon the race that physical sciences nearly died out. It was the one thing that came before them. Different sects of yogis began to make all sorts of experiments. Some made experiments with light, trying to find out how lights of different colors produce changes in the body. They wore a certain colored cloth, lived under one certain color, and ate certain colored foods. All sorts of experiments were made in this way. Others made experiments in sound, by stopping and unstopping their ears. And still others experimented in the sense of smell, and so on. The whole idea was to get at the basis, to read the fine parts of the thing, and some of them really showed most marvelous powers. Many of them were trying to float in the air or pass through it. I shall tell you a story which I heard from a great scholar in the West. It was told him by a governor of Ceylon, who saw the performance. A girl was brought forward and seated cross-legged upon a stool made of sticks crossed. After she had been seated for a time, the showman began to take out, one after another, these crossbars. And when all were taken out, the girl was left floating in the air. The governor thought there was some trick, so he drew his sword violently, passed it under the girl. Nothing was there. Now what was this? It was not magic or something extraordinary. That is a peculiarity. No one in India would tell you that things like this do not exist. To the Hindu, it is a matter of course. You know that the Hindus would often say, when they are to fight their enemies, "Oh, one of our yogis will come and drive the whole lot out." It is extreme belief of the race. What power is there in the hand of the sword? The power is all in the spirit. If this is true, it is temptation enough for the mind to exert its highest. But as with every other science, it is very difficult to make any great achievement. So also with this, nay much more. You most people think that these powers can be easily gained. How many are the years you take to make a fortune? Think of that. First, how many years do you take to learn electrical science or engineering? And then you have to work all the rest of your life. Again, most of the other sciences deal with things that do not move, that are fixed. You can analyze a chair. The chair does not fly from you. But this science deals with the mind, which moves all the time. The moment you want to study it, it slips. Now the mind is in one mood. The next moment perhaps it is different, changing, changing all the time. In the midst of all this change, it has to be studied, understood, grasped and controlled. How much more difficult then is this science? It requires rigorous training. People ask me why I do not give them practical lessons. Why? It's no joke. I stand upon this platform talking to you and you go home and find no benefit. Nor do I. Then you say it's all bosh. It's because you have wanted to make a bosh of it. I know very little of this science, but the little that I gain, I work for 30 years of my life. And for 6 years I've been telling people the little that I know. It took me 30 years to learn it. 30 years of hard struggle. Sometimes I worked at it 20 hours during the 24. Sometimes I slept only 1 hour in the night. Sometimes I worked whole nights. Sometimes I lived in places where there was hardly a sound, hardly a breath. Sometimes I had to live in caves. Think of that. And yet I know little or nothing. I have barely touched the hem of the garment of this science. But I can understand that it is true and vast and wonderful. Now, if there is any one amongst you who really wants to study this science, he will have to start with that sort of determination. The same as, nay, even more than that which he puts into any business of life. And what an amount of attention does business require, and what a rigorous taskmaster it is. Even if the father, the mother, the wife, or the child dies, business cannot stop. Even if the heart is breaking, we still have to go to our place of business, when every hour of work is a pang. That is business, and we think that it is just, it is right. This science calls for more application than any business can acquire. Many men can succeed in business, very few in this. Because so much depends upon the particular constitution of the person studying it. As in business, all may not make a fortune, but everyone can make something. So in the study of this science, each one can get a glimpse which will convince him of his truth and of the fact that there have been men who realize it fully. This is the outline of the science. It stands upon its own feet and in its own light and challenges comparison with any other science. There have been charlatans, there have been magicians, there have been cheats, and more here than in any other world, any other field. Why? For the same reason, that the more profitable the business, the greater the number of charlatans and cheats. But that is no reason why the business should not be good. And one thing more, it may be good intellectual gymnastics to listen to all the arguments and intellectual satisfaction to hear of wonderful things. But if any one of you really wants to learn something beyond that, merely attending lectures will not do. That cannot be taught in lectures, for it is life. And life can only convey life. If there are any amongst you who are really determined to learn it, I shall be very glad to help them. It's one of the great lectures of Vivekananda, so I have thought of reading it with you, not leaving to chance that you might read by yourself, because I really wanted you to read it. We are dealing with yoga, and this is an introductory lecture on yoga. Powers of the mind that can be studied scientifically. You can, by practicing with great patience, as he says, it may take 30 years even to touch the hem of the garment. Yoga is defined what you can do normally in many, many years. By practice of yoga, you can do in a short time. You can shorten, you can accelerate, you can attain to perfection. Therefore, the book that you have started a few days ago, The Synthesis of Yoga, is such a tremendous thing. Very few people have the chance to read this book. And you are so fortunate that you are reading it. Now we come back. I was telling you about the integral yoga. And I told you about Hatha yoga and about the Raja yoga. Now I tell you about the third yoga, which you have written down in your notebook. Five yogas are named. Hatha yoga, Raja yoga. Now the third one, Karma yoga. The yoga of works. As I have told you, you should ask three questions regarding yoga. What is the aim? What is the instrument? And what is the process? So let us ask the three questions regarding Karma yoga. What is the aim? The aim of Karma Yoga is to discover the Supreme Will. The Supreme Will, the will of God. And to allow that will to work through us. To be an instrument of God's will. Not only to discover the will of God, not only to discover the will of the divine, but to be the instrument of the divine's will. This is the aim of Karma Yoga. Now, what is the instrument? The instrument is that which is the most elementary thing of will in us. Just as body was the instrument of Hatha Yoga, mind was the instrument of Raja Yoga, the aim, the instrument of Karma Yoga is desire. You take the desire. Because in our life, all that we will is through desire. So you take that instrument. Take desire, And what do you do with that desire, that instrument? Now you put in a process. Now what is the process? We can say it in 3 minutes, but it takes many, many years to practice it. First, give up the desire for the fruits of action. Give up the desire for the fruits of action. This is the first process of Karma Yoga. Second, perceive that what you think is your action is not really your action. Constantly see your action and see, analyze any action that you are doing, you see, the origin of your action is elsewhere. You think it is your action, but that's a mistake. So correct that mistake. See that your action is not really your action. Then comes the next process. To discover the real origin of action, you make a practice, you offer your action to the divine. Whatever you are doing, you offer it to the divine. Like a gift. Whatever you think you are doing, you think it's like a flower, which you are offering to the divine. This is called sacrifice. Sacrifice your action to the divine. And when you sacrifice, miracle happens. This is the fourth process. When you give to the divine, you are able to touch the divine. If you give me a flower, you can touch me while giving the flower. And when you touch the divine touches you. You touch from your side to the divine, and then the divine also touches you at the same time, because you touch him, he touches you. And the moment he touches you, his action enters into you. His vibration enters into you. As soon as vibration enters into you, his action begins in you. And you discover what is his action, what is his will. And by discovering this will of the divine, you also find he is already vibrating in you. The moment you touch him, it begins to vibrate in you. So you become the instrument of the divine will. And then whatever you do is actually divine himself doing it through you. So there are these processes of Karma Yoga. You take desire as the instrument. We repeat now. You take the desire as the instrument. The first thing is that whatever you desire, normally you desire the enjoyment of fruits of action. Now this yoga says that first, you do not enjoy the fruits of action. You may have the fruits of action, but give up the enjoyment of the fruits of action. Still continue to work. Normally, when you are not to enjoy the fruits of action, we cease to work. So Karma Yoga says, don't do that. Do your work, whatever you are doing. But do not enjoy the fruits of action. It may produce fruits, but do not enjoy the fruits of action. This is a mastery over it. Mastery over enjoyment. Usually we work, we desire everything for enjoyment. So the first lesson of Karma Yoga is, do not enjoy the fruits of your action. That gives you great austerity in your being. Makes your personality. The personality which simply does something for enjoyment is a very weak personality. That personality can be won over very easily. Can be tempted very easily. But a strong personality is one who doesn't care for enjoyment. So this is the starting point of a real development of personality. Do not enjoy the fruits of your action. Second is, see that your action itself is not yours. Normally we always think that, oh, this is my action, I am doing it. There is a very beautiful line of a poem of a Gujarati poet, which simply says, I translate it for you into English, I do, that is the ignorance. I do, that is to say, always we feel, I am doing this. I do, that is the ignorance. It is like a dog which is moving under a cart and thinks, I am carrying the cart. You see the simile? It's like a dog which is walking under a cart and thinks that cart is moving because of him. As if the burden of the cart is upon his back and the whole cart is moving because of him. See, in one sentence he has given a complete lie to this ignorance. Whenever you say, I am doing it, think that you are like a dog walking under a cart, thinking that the cart is moving because of it's moving. So this is the second part of the process of Karma Yoga. And this is tremendous because normally all of us think we are doing. Karma Yoga says this is a false proposition. Psychologically, you are under an illusion. You are mistaken. Just as a dog would be mistaken if it thinks that the cart is moving because of its force, when it is only moving itself under the cart. The cart is moving by itself because of the bullocks and so on, not because of itself. So this is the second process of Karma Yoga. The third process is that when you are thinking that you are doing, it's very difficult to rub out this idea, I am doing, very difficult to rub out. So Karma Yoga says, to make everything easy, think that you are doing, but offer it to the divine. This is a process, a kind of a trick, you might say, device. Continue to think that you are doing, fine. But having done it, you say to the divine, this is for you. We give it as a gift. And when you give it as a gift, a miracle takes place. Because when you offer it, the divine touches you as you touch the divine. As soon as he touches you, you come to know that everything proceeds from him. He is the real doer. The Supreme Lord is a doer. And the moment you discover this, he begins to move in you already. To discover the divine will and to be the instrument of divine will takes no time between the two. There is no interval. To know the divine will and to be the instrument of the divine will happens simultaneously. Because he is already working in you. So you only discover, my Lord, he is working already. This is the Karma Yoga. In very brief terms, you have the whole book here of Karma Yoga, but I have told you the fundamental principles so that very briefly you can grasp. So to repeat, the aim of Karma Yoga is to discover the divine will and to become the instrument of the divine will. This is the aim. The instrument is desire. You touch your desire, concentrate upon your desire, and work on your desire. For working, the first thing is to say, I do not want to enjoy the fruits of my action. That's the first thing. So it touches the desire. It's actually, you will find your desire becomes very much weakened. Ultimately, desire is completely wiped out. When you follow the whole process, first it becomes weak. But says, do not therefore drop the action, because normally this is what happens. When you do not desire the fruits of action, we drop the action also. But don't do that. Karma Yoga says, continue the work. It's a very difficult task. Not to desire the enjoyment of fruits of action and yet to continue to work is very difficult. But gives you tremendous strength of action. It is said, action for the sake of action. Why do you act? Not for the enjoyment of fruits of action. Action for the sake of actions. Because action in itself is right to do. The right action is to be done for the sake of, because it is right. I may fail, doesn't matter. I may succeed, does not matter. I may enjoy, doesn't matter. I may not enjoy, doesn't matter. This is called a strong personality. This comes when you first process is, you take your desire and then begin to chop off the head of the desire. The head of the desire is the fruit of action. If you examine the desire, you'll find that the head of the desire is the enjoyment of fruit of action. If you chop off that head, then very often we feel we are down dead. We can do no work at all. There is no point in doing it. But Karma Yoga says, still continue to act. When you do that, then you will realize that every time you act, there is in you the sense, I am doing, I am doing, I am doing. So now take hold of this second process. I am doing, I am doing. Now Karma Yoga says, whenever you say, I am doing, think that you are like a dog who is moving under a cart. You are not the doer. Find out really, this is an illusion. Find out really who is doing, who is the doer. And you will find you are not the doer. Aham karta asmi, in Sanskrit we said, aham karta, I am the doer. Aham means I, karta means the doer. I am the doer, aham karta. And when you really examine, you will find, my Lord, I was not at all the doer. All action energies are moving in the universe. I am like a small little pebble in this universe, and all the winds are blowing around me, and I am being blown by the winds. I am not being blown by myself. I am being blown by all others. This is the truth that you will perceive when you begin to concentrate upon it. I am the doer, I am the doer. You will find I am not the doer, I am not the doer. But still, our psychology is so obstinate, even when you see that you are not the doer, still our mind thinks, I am the doer, I am the doer. Therefore, Karma Yoga says, third stage, think that you are doing, but offer it to the Divine. And the moment you begin to offer to the Divine enters into you and gives you the knowledge that He is the doer. Then you will discover His will and you will become the instrument of His will. So, aim, instrument and the process. Alright. Now we come to the next one. Jnana Yoga. Again we ask three questions. Samatha, you ask these three questions. Which are the three questions? Good. Now what is the aim of Jnana Yoga? The aim of Jnana Yoga is to know the being of God. In Karma Yoga, the aim was to know the will of God. In Jnana Yoga, the aim is to know the being of God. There's a difference between the will of God and being of God. Being is much larger. Will is only an expression. But being is the very stuff, the very heart, the very soul, the very self. So the aim of Jnana Yoga is the knowledge of the self. But S with a big cap, the supreme being, the supreme self. The aim is the knowledge, the discovery of the supreme being, and to become that very being yourself. Just as in Karma Yoga, the aim was to discover the will of the divine and also to be the instrument of the divine will. Similarly, in the Jnana Yoga, you discover the supreme being of the divine and also to become identical, to be one with that being, to be united with that being. So that is the aim. Now comes the question, the instrument. The instrument is intellect. Now you take hold of the intellect as the instrument. In Raja Yoga we said the instrument is mind. In Jnana Yoga we are using the word instrument is intellect. There is a difference between the two. Normally we say mind and intellect are the same. But yoga tells us there is a difference. Intellect is that part of the mind which distinguishes, which is capable of distinction. Intellect is that part of the mind which is capable of distinguishing, which makes a distinction between the truth and the false. Between the truth and the false. What is right and what is wrong. What is really real and what is simply appearing to be real. It distinguishes between the reality and appearance. That part of the mind which distinguishes between the right and the wrong, between the real and the unreal, between the reality and appearance, it is that part which is taken hold of as an instrument in Jnana Yoga. That's why many people think that Jnana Yoga is a difficult one. Because already you must have intellect. You must be aware of your intellect. So already you must be sufficiently developed. Hatha Yoga is easy because body existence is very easily seen by us. We can manipulate it very easily. Desire is much more easy also to see and to manipulate. But intellect already requires a great degree of development. That's why many people think that Jnana Yoga is the most difficult one. Later on we shall examine this question, is it easier or not. But anyway, it is true that unless intellectually you are aware, you cannot practice the Jnana Yoga. You must know the instrument of intellect. You must have developed the mind to such an extent, it is able to decide, to judge. That much capacity you must already have. That is why all the people who are asked to practice Karma Yoga, Jnana Yoga, they are given a long practice. Intellect is a process of intellect. Intellectual development is the first process. In all practice of Jnana Yoga, the individual is told to realize his intellect first, and for that the process is to think. Thinking is the real starting point of Jnana Yoga. You might say that the time that I came to you, we have started Jnana Yoga. Because I gave you many subjects of thinking and you have been put into the practice of thinking. So already you are doing Jnana Yoga. Many things we define When you define, you have to decide what is real and what is not real. Whenever you define anything, already you are judging what is real and what is not real. You are defining exactly what a subject is. We define what is philosophy, what is science. Therefore, we distinguish between what is philosophy and what is not philosophy, what is science and what is not science. So your intellect already began to develop and began to decide what is right and what is wrong, what is real and what is appearance. And when you study philosophy, there are many ways of learning philosophy. But if you are a Jnana Yogi, if you are doing the process of Jnana Yoga, study of philosophy can be by deciding or discriminating what is ultimately real and what is ultimately unreal. It's a true philosophical training. So, Jnana Yoga, first step is to think. First process is thinking. Second process is to think what is right and what is wrong, to discriminate between the truth and falsehood, right and wrong, real and unreal, reality and appearance. It's the second process of Jnana Yoga. The third one is to distinguish between ultimately real and ultimately unreal. The third step of Jnana Yoga. Now, this is a very long process. It may take 10 years. I have put only 10 years for you. But that is quite a short period. That is because we are moving on a very high speed, no? We are galloping, in fact. Actually, what you have done in 6 months' time could be done only in 2 years' time. So already you have galloped a lot. So since you are galloping, I am only putting 10 years. So, unless and until you are able to think what is ultimately real and what is ultimately not real, you are not entered into the gates, the real gates of Jnana Yoga. But having done it, prescription is, now comes the real Jnana Yoga. All these are only preliminaries. The real Jnana Yoga is, think what is ultimately real and what is ultimately unreal, again and again and again and still again and again further. It is called, in Sanskrit, the word is manana. M-A-N-A-N-A. Manana. When you think again and again of what is real, what is ultimately real and what is not ultimately real, and there can be many exercises. And in India, so many exercises have been discovered or created so that they may become a great help to you to think again and again and again. Then comes the next step. The next step consists of a double movement, a negative movement and a positive movement. The negative movement is to say, I am not unreal. Positive is, I am real. Normally, I think that I am the body. Realize first, you are not the body. You have the body, not that you are the body. It's a mistake to think that you are the body. You have the body. So, unreal and real, now you see the distinction. The reality is that you are more than the body and you have the body. But you are not yourself the body. So this is the first meditation, you might say. Think of it again and again and again. Whenever you think I am the body, remember you are not the body. You have the body, you are not the body. You are real. You are not, this body is only a part of it. You are something much more. You are the real self, the supreme self. So remember, you are the supreme self. You are not this. As long as you think, oh, I am the Supreme Self, that is also wrong. Because you, when you say you are only referring to your body, to your little self, but that is not the real self. You are neither the body, nor the life, nor the mind. These are three great illusions in which we live. We always think, I am the body, I am the life, I am the mind. These are unrealities. They are false ideas. You are not the body, you are not the life, you are not the mind. You have the body, you have the life, you have the mind. But you are not yourself the body or the life or the mind. This is the negative meditations. I am not the body, I am not the life, I am not the mind. Repeat it 1,000 times, 10,000 times, 1,000,000 times. I am not the body, I am not the life, I am not the mind. Then you go to the positive side. I am the Supreme Self. But when you say I am the Supreme Self, remember, you should precede it by saying I am not I. What I think myself is also not myself. Don't think that the Supreme Self is what you think you are. That is also falsehood. You have to realize that you are not yourself. What I think is myself is not yourself. It's only the ego. Aham. Aham bhava. It's only the ego. You are not the ego. When you say you or I, is not the ego. It is Supreme Self. I am vast. Sri Aurobindo had used the word union of the individual, human individual, with the universal and transcendent. Your individuality has to be united with the universal and with the transcendental, even that which is more than universe. That Supreme Being is more than the universe. And that is yourself. In which there is no I and no nor you. There is only one. Only one reality, one self. There is one Supreme Self. So even the statement, I am that self, is also wrong. There is only the self. That's all. There is only the Supreme Self. That's a real reality. So meditate upon this, I am the Supreme Self. Then cut it out and say, there is only one Supreme Self. That is the real reality. There is only one Supreme Self. Having run this, then now you say, this Supreme Self manifests as the universe, manifests as the individuals, manifests itself as the mind, as the life, as the body. So when you have done this whole circuit, then you have the aim of Jnana Yoga achieved. It's a long program, difficult program, but that is what Jnana Yoga aims at. And it is said there is nothing as pure as this knowledge. This knowledge is the purest. If you want to be purest, as we all should be, then we should remember that there is only one Supreme Self. This very perception delivers you from every impurity. Bhakti Yoga. Again, we put these three questions. What is the aim? What is the instrument? And what is the process? The aim of Bhakti Yoga is to discover the divine love. The divine love, not love as we understand it. The divine love. The divine bliss. Because origin of divine love is divine bliss, ananda. To discover the divine ananda and to enjoy the divine ananda. In Karma Yoga we saw that we normally like to enjoy the fruits of our action. So there was an element of enjoyment, which we were told don't enjoy. Now we are told in Bhakti Yoga, enjoy. Our aim is enjoy, but enjoy what? Not the fruits of action. Enjoy the divine love. To be in the embrace of the divine forever and ever and ever. That is the aim of Bhakti Yoga. To enjoy. That is a true enjoyment. That is why in Ishopanishad there is a very nice sentence. Tena tyaktena gunjitaha. By renouncing it, you enjoy. You renounce this enjoyment of the fruits of action. And then you enjoy the Supreme Divine. You renounce, this enjoyment you renounce. When you do that properly, you will enjoy the Divine Love. So that is the aim. Bhakti Yoga is to discover the Divine Love, Divine Bliss, and to enjoy that Divine Love and Bliss. This is the aim of Bhakti Yoga. Bhaktas are supposed to be madmen because when they really realize there's a madness and ecstasy, the joy which is so immeasurable, the brain itself begins to be completely quiet. Brain has no place in that joy. One dances and dances and dances. That's why many real bhaktas cannot but dance. Many bhaktas cannot but create. All kinds of artistic creations come out of the great love. In fact, all artists are basically bhaktas. All artists, all of you are artists, I know. And therefore, you are actually following the path of bhakti. All of you are in search of the divine creation. Your little artistic pieces are only little efforts. But when you reach the culmination of it, you can create the whole universe. Because the divine creates universe out of his great ecstasy. As Sri Aurobindo says, his whole world is a laughter of Shiva. He laughs and the whole world is created. The whole world is a laughter. It is to discover this and to enjoy it. That is the aim of Bhakti Yoga. What is the instrument? The instrument is emotion. Not the body, not the mind, not the desire, not the intellect, but emotion. What is the process? Our emotions, which are at present tied to small little things, this relationship or that relationship, this little thing to be enjoyed or that little thing to be enjoyed, you turn all these emotions to the supreme object of love. The one that is really worthy of love. All other things are only tidbits of life. The real thing to be enjoyed is the supreme Krishna, the delight of delight, the universal and the transcendental, the one being that's the source of all joy, an inexhaustible joy. So turn all your attention from these little things and pour all your love, all your emotions If you are angry, be angry with the Lord. If you are happy, be happy in the company of the Lord. If you are in a mood to fight, fight with the Lord. If you want to obey somebody, obey the Lord. If you want to serve somebody, serve the Lord. All your emotions, whatever emotions you have, you just pour them on the supreme object of love. And then by doing this, you'll find that divine response. And that's a miracle. It's not only on your part you go on thinking of God and loving Him. You find that He loves you much more than you love Him. Much more passionately. As Sri Aurobindo says, Bhakta discovers that the divine pursues him more passionately than you can pursue him. He loves you so much as nobody in the world can love you. And these are not illusions, these are real facts. He himself manifests. If you read the poems of Mirabai, for example, the dance that bursts out in her body when she sees Sri Krishna and finds Sri Krishna in passionate love of Mirabai himself. That love, imperishable love, unfailing love. You then realize that all what we call human love is bitter at the end. This is Sri Aurobindo's words. All human love is basically, ultimately bitter. Although while drinking it, it is very sweet. But when you analyze it, when you go to the depth of human, as long as it is human, unless you turn into the divine, if you turn the human love into the divine, then it is immortal. So, bhakti yoga consists of turning human love into divine love. This is a real process. In this process, there are three basic steps. Three basic steps. Straining yourself towards the divine. Driving. Second, the experience that you are separated from your beloved. You do not find him. You are striving after him. You don't find him. But sometimes he appears just for a little while. But that little while is so powerful that all the other moments you feel you are separated from him. Because everything becomes dry. That one moment when the divine appeared and touched you, the ecstasy of it was so great that all other moments are felt to be dry desert. So the process of bhakti yoga consists of striving even in that condition. And the ultimate is a union. You receive him, you obtain him, attain him. You allow that love to manifest through you. You become the brazier of that love, a powerful instrument of that love. Thereafter, wherever you see, everything is love. There is nothing which is bitter. Even bitterness itself becomes the divine. It is said of Mirabai that she was asked, she was sent a glass of poison. Her brother-in-law was very much opposed to her. So to get rid of her, one day the brother-in-law sent to her a glass of poison. And as usual, for Mirabai, everything was to be offered to the divine. She did not know it was a glass of poison. She offered it to the divine and said, first you drink and then I'll drink. That was her sadhana of bhakti. You drink first, then I drink it. And when she drank, she danced. The poison had become nectar. The touch of the divine love was a touch of nectar. This is the power of the divine love. When you reach that stage, even if poison is poured on you, it becomes nectar. Because everything is the divine nectar in this world. That is the power and magic efficacy of divine love. That is how many great bhaktas have been able to bear the torture, great torture, because they see the divine embrace in every torture. And that is really a fact. So this is the process of bhakti yoga. In a sense, it is no process. To strive and strive again and to be mad after the divine and then to enjoy the madness of the divine, that is the process. That is bhakti yoga. Alright, so we have now done all the important systems of yoga. And now we shall see what is integral yoga. Alright, this is all to explain only one word in that first line of the second paragraph of the synthesis of yoga. Alright.